Welcome back to Ladies and Gentlemen. Thank you for joining us today. Henrik here with Red Eyes TV. And today we are going to talk about the Charlottesville trial. James Alex Fields. The trial in Charlottesville has begun. Just at the outset, I think we're looking at a farce of a trial, looking at the material. Obviously, this man is a scapegoat. He's become a symbol for everything that happened that day in Charlottesville during the Unite the Right rally. And I don't think there's going to be a fair trial, unfortunately, for James Fields. And we have a guest with us today to kind of help us break this down a little bit. I have certainly not looked at every detail around the case. There's a lot of things that could be said, a lot of things that could be analyzed, and a lot of things that should be getting out to the public. And so we can, of course, hope that he's going to get a fair trial. We can, of course, hope that the defense is going to do a good job and go into all the details that should be addressed regarding what happened that day, and even how James Fields ended up in the situation that he did, and what had happened to him prior that day, and so forth. And so, with us on the show today to talk about this, we have a gentleman who goes by the handle Alt-Right Truth on Twitter, and he has done a lot of good work in terms of looking at the car accident, the car crash, in terms of making simulation based on the available video footage, listening to sounds and matching up videos, stabilizing videos, and out of this data creating like simulations to try to get closer to what actually happened. So he's done a forensic work at this stage about this. So welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
So why don't you tell us first, before getting to the details and the meat of this here, what made you interested in looking at this case in the way that you have, and spending the what I would assume is hundreds of hours at least by now, looking at the case, looking at all the footage, making all the animations, and making everything that you've done? What drew you to this?
Well, at first, I was I've never participated in any of these rallies or anything like that. So my participation has basically been, well, most people's participation, which is going on 4chan and Twitter and the like. And in the weeks after the trial, I would say let's say 3 weeks after Unite the Right, approximately, I was just like everyone else seeing there was other people on 4chan and elsewhere doing great work, breaking down some of the videos and doing great analysis. And Daily Stormer and Hunter Wallace in particular, and then, like I said, a lot of anonymous guys on 4chan. And so I was just scrolling through message boards and the like. But then all of a sudden it started to dry up, and I was a little bit frustrated at that because I thought there was more to it. And then soon after that, it got taken over by this whole incident got taken over by these. And Henry, you and I both are not strangers to conspiracy theories, so to speak. But in this case, there was no conspiracy, and it got completely taken over by some of these buffoons. And I suspect some of them are being malicious, but guys, I don't even want to say their names, but YouTubers who were saying that this was all an FBI setup, and that James Fields, there was a body double and a car swap and all this, and that's where all the energy went to. And then on top of that, there was the optics war, and everybody wanted to kind of forget about Charlottesville, so there was these. So all of a sudden, what went from just normal, typical, alt-right analysis of things, guys did great work, for instance, back in the George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin trial. And this was just like that at first, but then all of a sudden there was just this vacuum. And I just got kind of frustrated. And so slowly I started building up, my own arguments. And I guess I was expecting at some point for 4chan, generally speaking, to just kick into gear and start doing their analysis again. But it never really seemed to gain traction. And I seemed to kind of be out there largely. I would get, I would see, occasionally there'd be a good thread at 4chan or somebody on Twitter or Gab or what have you. But unfortunately, from my point of view, there haven't been too many guys doing great work. There have been some. There absolutely have been some. And I don't want to take all the credit. For instance, Jack Corbin on Gab has done great work. Some of these YouTubers, some of the guys I credit, Proxima One on YouTube. There's a guy, he's in the conspiracy movement, unfortunately, but I think he's now moved on from that. But his name is Cy Borgeson. That guy has collected every video he's gone in and captured every live stream from that you can get that the Antifa haven't stripped, and they have stripped many of them. But the ones that they haven't stripped, he's extracted them all and put them on YouTube. I mean, I'm talking about probably 100 videos and stuff, and that was just invaluable. So I don't want to say I'm the only one. That would be misleading, but it has been frustratingly quiet, I think, from the alt-right leadership. And so that was how I got into it.
All right. Well, interesting. We're going to talk about a lot of this here today. And what would you like to say about James Fields first? Because it's, to me, in a way, it's obvious that he's been, we'll get into that in terms of like what you think actually happened that day and why he's in the situation that he's now in. But what do we know about him and his past regarding both his association, I guess, to the alt-right and some of the scattered and various groups there. And it should be noted, too, for people who don't know, that it was many different people that showed up that day, many different groups. Kessler had arranged it in such a way that it was open to everybody, so everybody could come. And, of course, we've learned in hindsight that that's not the best situation right now. People can show up, which has malicious intent, and they show up with the wrong, symbol, and then the media gets their photo shoot, and then that's it. It's kind of my experience as well, in terms of like, seeing footage of like KKK people there that were standing in front of the cameras, literally, when you look at the media coverage of that day. And I was there as media to try to broadcast the speeches that were to be held that day. And I didn't see any of that from where I was standing. I didn't see any of these individuals that showed up that all the cameras were catching. So anyway, making a long story short, it was a mess. All these different people were there. But specifically about James Alex Fields, what do we know about him and his past?
Well, I'd say a fairly good amount. He's unfortunately kind of like a lot of young men nowadays. Young men of all races, but specifically young men. He comes from his single parent household because his dad died when his mother was pregnant with him, and then his mother became paralyzed in an accident when he was very young. And his mother, I believe her name is Samantha Bloom, she seems to be a very sincere, good, strong woman, and she's, I think, the biggest victim in all of this. Well, I mean, I was said from Heather Heyer, but my heart really goes out to her. But so James Fields, you can tell by looking at him, he's obviously out of shape. He's kind of puffy, guy, and he's had, like so many guys, he's on ADD medications and the like. He's been prescribed antipsychotics and things, but this is not uncommon nowadays at all. I mean, this is not something like where it's like 1 in 1,000 young men his age. It's now like 1 in 5 probably are on similar meds. So nothing too extreme in that sense, but he just seems to be a lonely kind of obnoxious young man. What I know about him comes from the media, and that's obviously very biased, but there have been statements from neighbors that he was very, just obnoxious and rude to them and things. And his mother was always trying so hard to get him to be a good boy, but he was, very, very rude and obnoxious and things. And I don't necessarily believe those statements that have come out from high school from one of his classmates and then his, like, freshman year history teacher. They give these over-the-top statements of him saying he was a neo-Nazi back then. I don't buy that. I'm not saying that there's probably a kernel of truth to that. He was probably interested in that sort of stuff back then, but I don't think he was, like, walking around saying, I'm a Nazi and all this as the media reports. But so he was, just a lonely guy and spent a lot of time on the internet and playing video games. There's accounts of him when he was, you'll hear accounts where they say, oh, he attacked his mom and all this sort of thing. These incidents that you'll hear about in the news are literally, he was 11 and 12, and I think the oldest one, he was 13 years old. The cops were called because his mom's in a wheelchair, and he's, being very aggressive and threatening to her, and so she calls the police. They're a lower-class couple. Him and his mother, and so I don't think they have other family around. So if there's any big problems, she has to call the police. There's a lot of situations like that nowadays, so it's not a big deal necessarily to say that she called the police. But anyway, he was literally like 12 years old when those incidents you hear about happened.
Yeah.
So that's just one misleading thing. And I think that, he was just a lonely young guy who got interested in a movement wanted to go to Charlottesville. He was literally lonely in the sense that he went out there 100% by himself. Now, this is, for some reason, the prosecution was trying to hide this at the pretrial hearing. So I guess it's worth emphasizing the truth on this. They've said that, and the media has always reported that he was there as part of Vanguard America because he was standing with them and carrying one of the shields. this is false. He obviously just walked up to those guys and they had an extra shield or something, because FBI and the Charlottesville State or the Virginia State Police and the Charlottesville Police Department have done extremely thorough analysis of this guy's life, and they've looked through, of course, his cell phone history and his PC history and social media statements, everything else, and he had no contact, zero contact with anybody who attended the United Right prior to going, with the possible exception of, you know, incidental contact, you know, on message boards and stuff, you know, coincidental, but not as far as planning to meet up with guys. He went there by himself. He was lonely. It's a long drive from Toledo to Charlottesville. It's about a day and a half. And he was also, this is actually something worth noting too. Of all the things to criticize about him, there is one thing to give him credit for nowadays, this is something to really credit young men for, is he held a job for 2 years. He was making $10.50 an hour as a security guard. Oh. He was stationed at a Target. And of course, they threw him under the bus right away. They fired him and dropped him that Monday morning. He had a little bit of money. I mean, not a ton. He collected life insurance when his father, you know, that he inherited when he was 18 from his father's death. That's how he was able to buy his car. And, you know, but he held a full time job, and, you know, good for him. There's a lot of young men nowadays who can't do that. So that's how he had the money to drive out there. As to whether he stayed in a motel on the way, he probably did. As to whether he had reservations on a motel for that Saturday night, I think he might have. And if that would be further exonerating. But I think most likely his plan was to drive. He wanted to go see Richard Spencer speak. That was his main purpose of going. And my guess would be he was hoping to, like, hang out and get to meet, you know, Richard Spencer and the TRS guys and all that sort of stuff, and then drive back a late Saturday night or early Sunday morning and return to work on Monday morning when he was scheduled to work and he had not quit. He was planning on returning to work. I was thinking, did he have a hotel reservations? And I think probably not. Every time I've taken a road trip like that, I've just stopped at motels off the interstate. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's
not a proof that he was like intending to do something or, you know, no. I mean, that's just what people do. So he's obviously in a situation where he's been, his prior connections, if you will, to all of this is pretty much non-existent. But you said that the prosecution is trying to argue this, though, that he has all these connections, it was in with all these different groups and stuff, right? Or the media maybe says this primarily, I should say.
It's the media, and the prosecution was kind of implying that. They're just trying to lump him in because they know it's almost like the RICO mindset, you know? If he's a part of this horrible mob, then it's, you know, that's my guess. They didn't offer the fact that he went there all alone. They were all in the pretrial hearing. They were the way the cop was talking, you would have gotten the impression that he was part of like Vanguard America and stuff. And it had to be the prosecution, or I'm sorry, the defense attorney. It wasn't until, you know, 20, 30 minutes in when she got up, she's like, hey, wait a minute. You went through this guy's whole cell phone. You've had an army of investigators going through every facet of this guy's life. Had he ever spoken with anybody? No. Did he, you know, I can read you the whole passage, but, it was a long thing, and she's asking him, so you searched through his computers, yes? Did you find anything? Did you find any contact there? No. You were through his cell phone, any contact there? No. Did you, did he have any contact with Vanguard America? No. Did he have any contact with any other group? No. You know, and the cop is obviously begrudging on it, and then he's like, well, we're still doing this. This, by the way, was 3.5 months after the car accident, and this cop is like, oh, but the investigation is still ongoing. Give me a break. Yeah. Keep it 3.5 months. It's like the Robert Mueller thing. It's like they'll probably be saying that during the Fields' trial. You know, oh, we're still looking for it, though. We'll find it one of these days.
Yeah.
You know,
or we'll plant it or do something, right?
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but let's clarify that. Obviously, beyond the fact that James Alex Fields' crime was to dare to show up to an event, which was meant to be protesting the removal of a statue, which of course is of the of an ancestor that helped to build America, and you know these guys, they're the the descendants of many of these people. So anyway, that to the side of just being totally unacceptable in America to have freedom of association, that's a different thing in itself. One of the things that they're using against him is that he allegedly shared a meme with somebody. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, well, he shared a lot of memes, but the one that we all do this, everybody does this, even if you're not an all-right person, we all share politically incorrect memes. We've all told jokes about ovens and everything else even long before we were, you know, politically incorrect, right? But so he had shared a whole bunch of these most of them actually are more like Magapede type memes on Facebook and the like. But when he went, when he was driving and heading out on Friday afternoon, starting his drive from Toledo to Charlottesville, a family member, I don't know which one, sent him a text message that said, make sure to be careful. Now, the context here, I think, is important. People have kind of forgotten about this now, but this Unite the Right was in August of 2017. In the months prior, actually more like a year, year and a half prior, there had been a whole bunch of these very high-profile clashes between the alt-right, and not just the alt-right, but the right wing at large, and Antifa. Most famously, I think, at Berkeley, and then there was a whole bunch of them, you know, all over Sacramento. You know, I can't even remember them all now. Charlottesville has just overshadowed everything. But
yeah, there were in Seattle. Remember, there was a guy that was shot and stuff like that.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, and you know, it was just, I mean, it was intense. It seemed intense at the time, but
definitely,
we didn't know anything yet. And so the family member said, "Be careful." You know, perhaps they were also referring to drive. No, they must have been referring to you know, the Antifa mob, right? Because that would be it shows his reply. He sends a meme of Hitler saying, and he says, "We're not the ones who need to be careful." So he's talking about, you know, this is obviously, you know, psyching up talk, you know, like a fighter before a fight. And it's a joke too. The alt-right, you know, you and I know, but hopefully James Oxfield's attorneys have learned that the alt-right has a black humor, you know, black comedy or gallows humor, as people might call it. You know, we make jokes about things which other people or which we're told in school and by the media are actually, you know, sacrosanct. And we like to slay golden calves, so to speak. It's part of our culture. And so that his reply was obviously just a part of our alt-right culture. It's the same thing you'd see on 4chan or any place else. And
yeah, their forbidden stuff is what's funny because it's not allowed, and that's what people are attracted to. Any psychologist would know this about kids and teenagers and those with a rebellious spirit, you know?
100%.
Yeah.
100%. And it's disingenuous, yeah. Even you don't even have to be educated about alt-right meme culture, really.
Exactly, right? Of course, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's disingenuous. But you know, these are evil people, so disingenuousness, that's nothing to them.
Yeah.
But in the federal hate crime indictment, Rod Rosenstein and Thomas Cullen said that is proof. That alone, mind you, is proof that his car accident was actually a terrorist plot.
Oh, geez.
His Hitler meme alone. I want to emphasize this. That alone is the only evidence they offered or presented that he had any intention of hurting anybody and that this was not a car accident. And that's that. He sent a Hitler meme. That's it, Henrik. So I made a comment the other day. Let's say, for instance, right now we've all made racist jokes. Let's say right now is a black UPS or FedEx driver drops something off on your front porch and it's wintertime and it's icy right now. Let's say they slip and they break a bone and the police come and they investigate. But then he finds out, oh, you got a racist joke on your phone. That must mean that you specifically put that ice there and you wanted to break this driver's bones. You wanted to assault them. This is a racial hate crime. That's the analogy to what this is, literally.
Right.
Is that he made political jokes, and therefore, if an Antifa is hurt, he had intended to hurt them. It's nuts. So, anyway.
Yeah, that's it's tragedy that it's gone this far, but this is what we're looking at in terms of the trial here now of James Field, is that obviously everything is going to be used against him, everything he's ever done. But as you said, his life, his past have been waded through like with a fine-tooth comb. They have found very little to imply that. Again, I don't know what the pitch is, obviously, of the prosecution here. If they're going to say he intended to do this, he had it planned all along, it was premeditated, etc. I would assume that they are going to go this route, but we'll just have to see. The problem with the trial, though, is, of course, that it's behind locked doors, despite the high-profile nature. It was the same, I remember, in Norway? That one was behind closed doors as well. With
Breivik,
yeah, stuff like that. So you'd think that these really high-profile cases that potentially is going to... Well, it's a public interest to a lot of people. They want to find out what happened, how do we prevent it from happening again, whose fault was it, etc., all this kind of stuff, that they would be public and open, but it's not. So,
well,
yeah, go ahead.
little bit. Here in America, it is constitutionally forbidden to have a secret trial. So it is open to the public, but it's not being broadcast either on television or like a stream on the city.
Do you think anyone could show up? I mean, I know that they're expanding like the room for the trial, obviously, into what was it, the Opera House or something, or
yes, no, yeah, anybody could show up. They're not allowed to unless you're disruptive or something.
Okay.
I'm sure that they'll let Antifa disrupt. In fact. There was one account, I forgot, I think it was the Charlottesville Daily Progress, they described that when Fields was brought in, just on the first day of just jury selection, the crowded room of leftists, and they said they were all muttering and murmuring, and all of a sudden it was like Mel Gibson in Braveheart, you know, when he's brought in, and all the, you know, the English people are like throwing stuff at him. Like, so they'll allow Antifa to do their thing to a certain extent. The judge will kick them out if they go too far, I think. But you know, anybody is allowed to go in, but nobody from the alt-right is going. Nobody. Jason Kessler actually reached out to me on Gab, and he said, you know, you really ought to go. And I said, I don't live anywhere near Charlottesville, and I couldn't commit that sort of time anyway. I said, isn't there somebody else? I mean, we're going to have, you know, when I say we, I mean just the alt-right in general. There's going to be a bunch of guys there, right? We've got a bunch of alt-right guys living in the Deep South. Somebody will be able to show up here and there. He says, no, nobody's going. And sure enough, on Monday, in Antifa, a big Antifa website, I forgot which one, was gloating. They said, today at the trial, you know, I've counted 60 of our comrades, you know, united in support of Heather, and there was no fascist there at all to support James Fields. And that got, like, when I saw it, it was like 65 retweets and a whole bunch of likes. So they're celebrating the fact that this guy's all in there with no right-wing support. But technically, yes, the courtroom is open to the public, and you could go. But yeah, you're going to be outnumbered 65-1 from the count, or 60-1 based upon that guy's estimate. So it would be pretty dangerous.
Not something you'd want to do necessarily. And again, because of the high profile, because of everything, the hype, the insanity really around this, and the way that it's been used. Because obviously, you know, it's a case which they're seeking to make sure that they scare people into submission. I sincerely believe that the establishment is not interested at all in having any kind of opposition to the current agenda of the population replacement, the displacement. Again, remember what the motive was of the protest to begin with. The protest was about protesting the removal of Robert E. Lee, the statue. That was what it was organized around. It kind of morphed into a little bit something else after a while, but there were speakers there. And again, you know, I'm sure they would have addressed this as one of the main issues. There's an attack on Southern heritage in America, and this, as we've seen in the wake of it, has been extended. They're removing statues, you know, all over America and other parts of the world too, around the West. So that was the contention, right? So the establishment doesn't want to have us put up any opposition to this. So a case like this is perfect for them because it shows that they can basically, you know, lead this sheep to the slaughter and then make sure that they scare other people into submission and say, if you show up at any of these events, if you protest any of this that's happening, this might be you. You might end up in the situation. You will be, if not beaten by left-wing groups, you could end up in a situation like this with a car, and you will be, because, I mean, think about it. He's already guilty, right? By definition, by the cultural narrative, the standard the media has said, is that this guy is guilty. Now it's just about the defense trying to make sure that they're trying to defend and say he's not guilty. But you made this point before, the prosecution, are they even going to prove that he did this and this was premeditated?
No, they're not. The prosecution is going to be airing a soap opera. That is it, and that is that. And I say this, it's perfectly clear from what they went over at the pretrial hearing and in their federal hate crime indictment, and based on what I've read in their questions to the prospective jurors. They have a soap, and based on their witness list, it's a soap opera. That's it. They're bringing up Heather Heyer's mother, Heather Heyer's black friends, all these people and victims. And they are the people who were hit hurt in this car accident. There were people who were seriously injured, you know, and, you know, God bless them and everything. Nobody obviously wishes that bad on them, although there are qualifying remarks that need to be said. They shouldn't have been out there, but that's a separate issue. Nevertheless, they didn't deserve to have their legs broken and all this. But it's just, that's all the prosecution's case is bringing up victims of the car accident. Now, wait a minute. The case against James Field isn't that people were injured. Everyone knows people were injured. That's in the stipulation of facts. The case against him is first degree murder, that he had planned to kill people. So what evidence are they going to be bringing up for that? Nothing. They will not be bringing up any case at all. So typically, you know, most people understand it. In law, the burden of proof is on the prosecution to prove, you know, guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. They're not going to be bringing any case at all. They're just going to be counting on people's prejudices, counting on people's anti-white and specifically anti-white activist prejudices to convict this guy. But there's no evidence against him because he did not he didn't plan this. This was an accident. This was a car. There's no accident evidence that this was not a car accident. Zero evidence at all that this was not a car accident. And so they're not going to be presenting any because there's nothing to present. They're just saying it. And so it's interesting if you think about if you look at the witness list as an example, all of the experts and all the forensic data is expected to come from the defense. The prosecution, I mean, they're going to show videos of the car accident and videos of people, you know, women's legs being broken and stuff like that. But that doesn't show anything about intent. It's got zero to do with intent. So their entire case is just going to be a soap opera. We're supposed to feel sorry for these people. And like I said, we can feel sorry for them, but that's got nothing to do with James Oxfield's guilt.
So let's deconstruct this, because if we have people tuning in that are that already, you know what happened and the media has established it, there's a clear case. He did it intentionally. He wanted to kill people. He is a white supremacist, but yet somehow he went there to murder a white woman, you know, let's say. But let's take that at face value and let's break that down, and then you give us what you have found with the analysis that you have done. Like what actually happened? What is he even doing there to begin with? And how did he end up in that situation? So let's break the whole car accident down and how you saw that it transpired, because obviously they had hit and attacked the car before he crashed into somebody.
In another car.
Yeah. Go ahead. So let us know what happened.
Well, the state of emergency was declared, I believe, at 11:30 in the morning, and him and several other people were lingering around. And as the afternoon wore on, as it went from 11 to 12, 12:30, fewer and fewer alt-right people were there, and more Antifa were there. And so they were getting more and more outnumbered. And if you actually see videos from the alt-right people leaving, you can see them in many cases, like shoulder to shoulder. In some cases, they even made trains where they're putting their hands on each other's shoulders, you know, and stay that close together. They were that scared. They were so outnumbered and so being attacked. And he had urine sprayed on him, by the way. That's in the and been admitted in court. You can actually see that in some of the photos. So that had happened to him at some point. 11:30 in the morning, perhaps some Antifa had sprayed piss on him. That also happened, I mean, to many people there, but it's on record, has happened to Katie Kirk's cameraman too. That I don't know if you know Katie Kirk, she's a big former NBC talking head.
Was it the Taylor Lawrence girl?
Taylor Lawrence was attacked. I don't think she had urine sprayed on her. Katie Kirk is like, she, in America, she's huge. She's like...
I know who that is. I thought you meant her sidekick or something like that, but yeah, okay.
No, it might have happened to Tara Orange. Might have had urine sprayed on her too. I don't know about that, but I know specifically Katie Kirk's cameraman. So anyway, so James Fields had been attacked had urine sprayed on him, and that counts as a felony assault, just for the record, in America. And so him and the three other guys were sticking together, just as I described before. Everyone is just, all the guys in the white polo shirts are just like, we've got to stay together. So he stayed with three strangers, they were. Perhaps they were lost. I don't know if they were trying to find their car for a while, but it was approximately 12:30 or so before they finally, decided to leave, and they got to their car, and he dropped those three guys off at their parking garages or wherever their cars were parked. So at approximately 12, jump forward about 40 minutes. I'm off. My timeline's a little bit off. So he, about 1:15 or so, he's dropped all those guys off. So he dropped all those guys off at the parking garage, and now he's trying to get out of town. Only he's never – this is a town with one-way streets, and it's – you know, there's all these Antifa all over the streets, and he doesn't know where he is or what the hell where to go. I can tell you personally, this is I vividly remember the very first time I rode in town, very much like Charlottesville. It was a college city. And it was all one-way. It was the first time I ever drove on one-way streets. I can tell you, I was completely confused and did not know what the hell was going on. So that's, I think that the one-way streets also were just throwing them off. And it's frustrating if you're driving and you don't know where to go or how to even turn or anything like that. And that's speculation though. But I would certainly guess that all the one-way streets in the town were playing a big part in his confusion and stuff. So he dropped these guys off at the parking garage. all three of them have said they've given sworn statements that they've talked with him, you know, in the car as they're driving around and he's dropping them off at their cars. They were chit-chatting along the way, and they all said, no, he gave no indication of anything other than wanting to get out of town. Mm-hmm. He had no plans to hurt anybody.
Right.
So all of them, hopefully, are going to be witnesses for the defense. The witness list was sealed for their safety, so we don't know who those guys are, but they're all right guys, and they will be doxed if they're called as witnesses. Oh, and perhaps they're just their sworn statements will be added to the record. I don't know. But and so then so he's lost. Now he's going down Market Street. Market's a pretty main thoroughfare. It's perhaps a half a mile north of where the car accident would occur. Normally he would keep going straight because Market's a big thoroughfare. But the Antifa had moved this sign for reasons we don't know, presumably just because the same reason they throw newspaper kiosks and they, you know, throw rocks through windows and stuff just to cause mayhem. But they'd moved this road closed sign and blocked off Market Street. So as he's trying to go straight down this main thoroughfare, he's forced to turn. And there's only one way to turn because it's a one-way street. So it's not as if he can turn right or left. He can only turn left into the Antifa mob. And the Antifa moved that road closed sign. I don't know if people are watching it, but in my little simulation there, the photographs of it are in the Heat Report. There's no question that this is what happened. So then he drove down and there's a car right in front of him, incidentally, that gray Toyota Camry. That was immediately right ahead of him. So he goes right to this main crosswalk, and then he backs up. Now, this is a point important for rhetoric. People say that he backed up, and then he was to build up speed. They say so that he could accelerate. There's two problems with that. First, he backed up for well over a minute. So that's problem number one. That is, if you want to back up, I'm sorry, you're going to back up, and then, you know, zoom. Second, he drove 17 miles per hour. You don't need to back up to accelerate to 17 miles per hour. So that theory is completely false.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hear that a lot. He backed up, paused to accelerate. That is false. You don't need to back up to accelerate to 17 miles per hour. I just want to hit that point because I'm seeing that all over Twitter and in all the mainstream media articles. But he backed up, paused for about 65, 70 seconds. Now, what is the average? If you're 20 years old, Henry, you're lost in a town. You've never been there before, you're trying to get out of a town, and you pull over, put your car in a park. What are you most likely doing?
Check the GPS, obviously. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's. I mean, I know. I don't know this. The defense has so far stayed silent, but I think the safest assumption. And there are photographs of him with his smartphone there. Virtually everybody has one nowadays. So I think it's a safe bet to assume that rather than pulling back and plotting some terrorist attack or other nonsense, he was pulling back and looking at MapQuest trying to figure out how to get out of there. So, and then he pulled forward, still going, going, there's different estimates, but basically the average speed was around 21 miles per hour. He was still, and then he slowed all the way down to 17 miles per hour until his car was attacked, not once, but twice. He's at this point, as he's driving forward, he's about 15 or so feet in front of Heather Heyer. He's going 17 miles per hour. His car is basically idling speed. That's it. Just as if the speed your car would go if your foot was off the accelerator and you're just, you know what I mean? And then his car gets hit from behind, and his car gets hit in rapid succession like this. Like his car gets hit from behind by one attacker, and then his car gets hit on the passenger side by another attacker.
Mm-hmm.
He hits the accelerator, not much. He doesn't put pedal to the metal, but he does hit the accelerator. He goes up to perhaps 25 miles per hour. He hits Heather Heyer and many other people. Heather Heyer dies. And then immediately a whole swarm, he's besieged. His whole car, we've all seen these videos, his car is besieged with Antifa right away. This time they're not just hitting the bumper and stuff. This time they're bashing in all the windows and everything like that. So, and there's also, as his car, windows are being bashed in a new video, thankfully, which I call Stick Girl's video, but this video was just released a month or so ago, we can see an Antifa pulling a gun on him. So he has his car being attacked. He's having a gun pulled on. Admittedly, he can't necessarily see all this going on. He just knows his windows are being exploding inward and everything like that. But it's worth pointing out that a gun was being pulled on him here. Then he backs up. And why is this important to note is because the prosecution in the pretrial hearing made a big fuss. Why didn't he get out to help these injured people?
Well, right. Clearly, yeah.
Because he's a terrorist. They made the cop himself went out of his way to say this, and the prosecution were hitting this point. Did he offer any relief to these victims and all this? Again and again and again, they were saying this. What would you do, dummy? You know, I mean, of course, why be outraged? We know why they're asking. We know these people are not asking these questions in good faith. we know that they're asking these, you know, maliciously. They know exactly why he didn't stop there, because he was besieged. Anyway, so it's important to note that when people say, because the prosecution thought that that was such a big gotcha, you know, that he didn't get out of his car to help these people out, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously, exactly. And the car, you know, needs to be pointed out too, but it obviously was attacked before he sped up. And there's one photo, yes. And I think that that's rolling here too. We'll get to see that. But you can see that the brake lights are on, right? So he actually, he did brake at one point.
Yes.
And then someone was hitting him from behind there. That photo, you can see the brake lights are actually on. So he's actually trying to stop at one point. And then, you know, the people with the flags or whatever, you know, sticks, they're hitting the car from behind and stuff. And you said, you reasoned that maybe this got him scared, that he saw, thought someone was shooting at the car or something, even, potentially?
Yeah, perhaps. That's Jason Kessler's theory. Jason Kessler's theory is that he thought that was Dwayne Dixon or somebody like that shooting at him. Not unreasonable. It's very possible. I don't know. My thinking is that's not even necessary. You know what I mean?
Right.
Perhaps it's true, but even if it wasn't, even if take Dwayne Dixon out of the equation, just imagine you're sitting in your car right now and you just hear bang, bang. What do you do? I have a friend. We had a big problem with our kind friends from the inner city throwing bricks over the overpass, and then they had to put these big chain link fences up. I had a friend who was a victim of one of those. Somebody threw a stone over the overpass. You know what he did? He ducked. That's just your answer. He didn't know it was a brick, or he didn't know where it was coming from. He just all of a sudden, bang! What does he do? He ducks. He flinches and he ducks. He told me this straight up. And, I think that when he just heard this bang, bang, he flinched and he ducked down. I think, you know, I don't know that for certain, but now whether he reasoned that it was a gun and he really panicked, perhaps, you know, and if we get more security camera video of Dwayne Dixon, perhaps that was the case. But even like I said, take Dwayne Dixon out of the equation, his reaction, while perhaps it's not ideal, is perfectly understandable, you know, and it's certainly not domestic terrorism.
You know, it's a big difference between, some of the, there's been comparisons, of course, that people said, well, it's virtually like an Islamic attack that we've seen where they use vehicles to run over people. And this is very much different because you wouldn't, you know, brake and try to, you know, slow down and even honk, right? That's also one of the things. You actually honked and try to get them to, like, be alert to the car, get out of the way, like, I'm coming through, I need to leave. He felt threatened at that point, is the theory. And then he basically sped up to try to get away from there. Or, as you said, when they hit the car, he ducked and maybe sped up at that point or something and then hit. You know, it's obviously very difficult to know exactly what happened and stuff like that, but we try to piece it together as good as we can. The chances are he was scared for the mob and he wanted to get out of there and he was panicking. And the more that they were antagonizing him, he freaked out and he tried to speed up and get out of there. And that's why you call this an accident as opposed to a premeditative, intentional attack by, you know, running people over with his car. You can see in footage from, let's say, New York or something like that, where you have an Islamist that jumps into a car, goes up on a driveway, and he's doing, what, like 45 miles an hour, 50, maybe even 60, and plowing and hitting as many as he can. He certainly doesn't brake and honk and, like, to avert it or alert people to his presence. And there's other cases like this in France and stuff like that, too, where it happens. And so I think that the comparison is totally off base, to be honest.
No, absolutely. It's completely contrived. There is zero evidence that he had intended to hurt anybody. Zero. You and I are going over all these details now, and we're doing, you know, trying to get into his head and exactly the specifics and stuff. The burden of proof isn't on us in a court of law. It's on the prosecution. The prosecutions are supposed to be the one presenting all this evidence. They're supposed to be the ones pulling the car's EDR out and doing all this forensic analysis. They're not going to do any of that because there is no evidence. You know, so all of our defense of him right now and all of our explanation is superfluous. In a proper court of law, the defense attorney would not have to say a single thing that we've just said. They should not have to say anything. They should say the prosecution made no arguments. They talked to a bunch of people who were injured in a car accident. That's it. There's no, so it gets, in some sense, it's very frustrating that we have to do all this, but it's not even necessary. There's no evidence. Like you made the obvious comparison to the you know, the guy, Nice, France, Barcelona, Spain, New York, in New York, all these other
Germany,
there's a long history.
Yeah, a lot of them.
Actually,
UK.
I have, it's interesting. I have a AP article of the history of these automotive terrorist attacks. And every single one, I believe there was eight that they counted, every single one was a large truck or van. They usually like it was a refrigerator truck in Nice, France. In New York, it was a rented big U-Haul, you know, a truck. And on and on. The only exception was, of course, they counted James Oxfield's accident as terrorism, which, of course, is absurd. But the only exception, there was some guy, like some schizophrenic guy in Melbourne, Australia, who'd run people over. And he had a sedan. But apart from that, every one of the times there had been documented Islamic terrorists, a guy had rented and then targeted, you know, drove up on the sidewalks or on in bike paths and things like that, and targeted people. James Fields stayed in the middle of the darn road. He crashed into another car in the middle of the street. There's a great photograph of him as he's first going down. It's one of those ones that was scrolling through there. But you can see how close so many people were to him on the sidewalk. If he'd wanted to kill people, he could have literally turned his, just flinched his hands, you know, 10 degrees to the left and killed 12 people in an instant right there. The idea that, you know, so the theory, the prosecution's absurd theory that this was an intentional attempt to hurt people is flies in the face of all the evidence. And they, you know, we have all the evidence exonerating them, but that's not even necessary. They have no evidence, you know, convicting them, so to speak, other than the people were hurt. People are hurt in car accidents every day. This is an important piece of rhetoric, is that there are 2,000 pedestrians every year killed in car accidents. And Heather Heyer was, unfortunately, one of those pedestrian deaths. These things happen all the time. So in all those, let's say there's 2,000 pedestrian deaths in 2017, you know, in the 1,999 prior, you know, aside from Heather Heyer, nobody even thinks, is this a domestic terrorist? People say, no, it's an accident. Things happen.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I mean, it bears repeating that. It's also, of course, he was put into a situation involuntarily, potentially, right? There was the moving of the road sign. There was people around him that had previously had threatened him. As he got closer to the bigger crowd, they were hitting the car, and that made him freak out further.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, the question could be like, okay, how much was on him in that situation? It's not just an accident where you lose control of the vehicle and you crash into someone accidentally. This was like he was being specifically targeted for being
right
there, which led to the whole chain of events which occurred, whatever the truth of the matter is. Do you think he'll get a fair, is this the kind of stuff that they'll go into at all during the trial and like go into the nitty gritty details of this stuff and like try to really sort this out? Or is it just going to be like glossed over, most of it?
Well, I do have faith in his attorneys. What I don't have faith in, I certainly don't have faith in the judge. And based upon what Christopher Cantwell and everyone else has told us about the juries, the public out there in Charlottesville, and this jury pool is only from Charlottesville proper. It's not from like the whole, you know, region or anything like that. It's just from the city itself. And that's what I don't have faith in. But I do believe they're going to put up a good defense for him. I don't necessarily agree with the strategy, what I'm hearing right now. But I think that they're going to do it in good faith, and I think it's going to be a vigorous defense, even if it's perhaps a little bit flawed. I don't think that they're throwing the case, as Ann Coulter wrote, that she feared might happen, which does happen. And so I don't think there's anything like that. And I think that, on the whole, it's going to be not a pure kangaroo court. The charges are what's absurd. I mean, it's the kangaroo court events are at the charging stage. You know what I mean? The fact that he's on trial for this. There's other things which are, you know, also like, you know, Banana Republic's court. But just the very fact that they charged him with this. And, you know, I think, most people know this, but I think this also bears repeating, is that, liberal, reporter Taylor Lorenz had a tweet. She was at the police station, an hour or so after the car accident. And she said this was just a car accident. The cop said he didn't have any intent. That's the other thing. They had this hours long police interrogation with them. Typically, those police interrogation videos with suspects are public. You know, media just asks for it and they get it. And they've never been released here. Why not? Because it's exonerating. Because James Fields is saying, no, I didn't intend to hurt anybody. I'm sorry. I was scared. And it was just a car accident. That's why they never released it. And right. Hopefully his attorneys bring that up, show that at the trial. And, Taylor Lorenz was on record with that.
What about the speed of the vehicle? There was that could be an interesting note as well. There was, again, obviously speculation in how fast it was going, but that's part of the equation here, that if you do intend to drive into someone, I would assume that you would want to drive as fast as you possibly can to inflict as much damage as possible. But what do we know about the speed of the vehicle?
Well, Henrik, just go to New York Times or go to USA Today or go to the Boston Globe. They'll tell you the miles per hour the car drove. No, I'm just teasing. They don't say a word about it. Why don't they? Why is it a big secret, the speed of this car? So, yeah, everyone's covering this up, right? Nobody's saying a word about it. You've never heard one time the actual speed. They always use these words which make it sound like it was some great speed. The Charlottesville Police Department says high rate of speed. Think about the numbers in your head when you think, maybe you're thinking 50 miles an hour, if you hear that. The Washington Post said that he drove at a rapid clip. They always use these vague words. Not once will you hear an actual miles per hour, his average speed or the speed at the point of impact. Not once. Why? Well, we know why, because these great researchers, Proxima One on YouTube and a gentleman, Occam's Router, they both independently of each other did their own estimates on speed, and they both used two different methods, incidentally. Now, these are estimates because, they're relying on blurry videos, but the fact that they came to the same conclusions approximately independently, bolsters the accuracy of this. They both came to his average speed was approximately 21 miles per hour from the time he crossed, that Brick Street, Main Street, and went down there. Basically the Brennan Gilmore video, where you're looking at his bumper, that video, you're kind of given the impression that he drove, at a high rate of speed. That whole time, he's driving 21 miles per hour at average. Now, it's at different points. He's driving 17 miles per hour at the start. It looks like he's continually going about 17 miles per hour until his car is struck. And then he speeds up, quote-unquote, to the, outlandish speed of 25 miles per hour. But he was slow. Perhaps he was going to stop and try to reverse. We don't know. But perhaps he was going to stop right there because he was basically 17 miles per hour is basically idling speed. He was basically just had his foot off the brakes and was just idling forward. And it's also a fairly steep hill too. So and Heather Heyer was, like I said, I don't know whether we talked about this, but she was about 15 feet in front of him. When you see the image in your screen there, the back guy striking him, Heather Heyer is approximately maybe, I'd say 15 to 25 feet in front of him, dead center of the street, right where his car is. The other thing, this is maybe a little bit superfluous, but it's worth saying too, is that this is 2 hours after the state of emergency was declared, meaning, anybody who didn't have business on the streets was supposed to be off of them. And these people are jaywalking. That area that they're on right now is not for pedestrians. It's for cars. There's big sidewalks there.
Yeah.
That's where you're supposed to be, dummies and whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, exactly. I mean, that's true. And I mean, let's repeat as well for potential newcomers to all of this that, what happened, of course, is that there was a permit for the people that was attending the rally, and it was revoked, as you said, in the beginning, in the middle of it. But then basically the police, the law enforcement were pushing I'm calling them protesters because they were protesting the removal of the statue, right? So then there were counter-protesters to the protest. But anyway, so the right wing, I guess we can say, for the ease of so people understand what we're talking about, they were literally pushed into the arms of these people.
Yep.
In other words, we have to repeat that the whole situation was created by law enforcement, and even that independent report that we've that flashed by a couple of times in some of the videos that we're playing also came to the agreed with this position more or less. It was negligence and this shouldn't have happened and why did they do this and stuff like that. And so, this is where I go back to the conspiratorial thing, that they wanted this to just completely turn into chaos so that they could use it. I mean, there was military vehicles being brought in and all kinds of stuff towards the end of this thing, and they wanted something to happen so that they could use it. And they got
sure.
they got what they wanted in this case. And look at how it completely has collapsed people who are legitimately concerned with the kind of things that some of the people that attended the rally wanted to address and highlight by showing their presence there,
Yeah, no, there's no question. They were hoping for they were expecting, I should say. He said they were expecting, gunfire or, big, even more of a chaotic storm than actually happened. and they kind of had to settle for this car accident. You know what I mean? He says that they were really hoping that at some point somebody's going to get shot, or a lot of people were going to get shot, based upon, you know, his reading of the Charlottesville Police Department's transcripts and the comments that the mayor and people on city council and stuff have made. So yeah, I don't have any doubt at all that what you said is true, that they were absolutely wanting people to get hurt and people to get, and they love this. I mean, you see the soap opera theatrics, they relish the whole incident, the people in the media and the people in Charlottesville.
Let me just reference that for people who are listening to the radio version only as well. Let me go back there again. It's that independent report, independent review of the 2017 protest events in Charlottesville, Virginia, by Hunton and Williams. Check that out, folks. The final report, it's pretty interesting. It's a travesty. It should never have happened. But again, we don't have to get into the details of that. A lot of people have talked about that. It is what it is now. We can't change history and go back in time and change something. But so what we're talking about here is basically that there should be a fair trial. There should be a fair and objective and honest examination of this, as there always should be for any case, no matter what happens, right? And I fear that we won't, because in the view of the public, this guy is already guilty because the media has spun this narrative. And so, as you said before, it might not even be a situation where the prosecution actually proves what happened, because they don't have to. So the defense will be literally just, I mean, again, who knows what tactic they will do if that doesn't happen, if the prosecution doesn't actually prove, point by point what happened, etc. But it's just, it's such a travesty. And the fact that this, guy might just have been he's literally being used in a much larger politicized, hyper-politicized event and a, what should we call it? It's a larger symptom of what has been happening politically, right, in America, with further polarization, with, as you say, all these events that was leading up to the Charlottesville event, where it got more and more violent. It was just, I mean, it was crazy to see during the 2016 Trump presidential campaign, for example, the way the Trump supporters were attacked. I don't think that anyone should be surprised that people came there outfitted to be able to defend themselves with shields and things, because everyone saw what had happened in the prior years, you know?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And not just at, you know, alt-right rallies, but also at outside of Trump's own, Trump's rallies.
Right. And yeah.
Remember the one outside at Chicago that was canceled because there was too many.
That's right. Yep.
And Black Lives Matter people showing up. There was a great meme. Actually, Mike Cernovich, to help people, tweeted it out. He showed all these photographs of Trump supporters outside of Trump's own rallies who were violently assaulted. And he said something like, you know, Trump, you're so worried about yourself, being slandered by Robert Mueller. You should worry about your own supporters, too, or something to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, this was something it was, that's the purpose of Antifa, right? It's to scare us, right? And so they've succeeded at that. And so James Fields had and everyone else there had every right to, go in unexpecting to be assaulted, because that's, in fact, frankly, they'd be irresponsible if they did not expect to be assaulted. So, the idea that maybe he said this, he sent the Hitler meme response is a joke anyway, but, is probably understandable given the climate that was created. But yeah, there, I think the point that you were making, was that they're trying to have a chilling effect on white people, and there's no question about that. It's obviously what they're doing. The best examples, and they're also trying to create a mythos. I said that in one of my videos. There's a couple of mythos I compared it to. First is Trayvon Martin. You're right, where his name is just symbolic, you know, to the American left is like a victim of white aggression and all of this. Thanks for putting – right now, Henry put up on the screen a meme I created comparing Fields to Zimmerman. And the trials are so incredibly similar in so many ways that I couldn't believe it when I stopped to think about it. But the other big comparison that I make is Matthew Shepard. He was a murdered gay guy in Nebraska. Now, I don't think you were in America at this time, but I would say in the late 90s and early 2000s, if you were in America, like just the name Matthew Shepard just symbolized, you know, horrible Americans who just don't get the, you know, the peaceful, wonderful people that gays are. And everything about Matthew Shepard was indeed murdered and all that, but everything that we were taught about his case was a lie. Everything. And not only was it a lie, but everybody involved with it, cops and so forth, knew that what was being said in the media was a lie. He was not murdered because he was gay. He was murdered by, you know, a fellow homosexual, not somebody who freaked out when they heard he was gay. We had this mythos that basically he walked into a bar and a couple of like evil Christians heard he was gay, and then they chained him up to the back of their truck and they drove him. Everything was a lie. Everything. But they like these. They like now they can say to this day they'll have a new Matthew Shepard law in, whatever, Wisconsin or something, a new Matthew Shepard memorial in Washington, D.C. And same thing with Trayvon Martin. We'll have a Trayvon Martin honorary degree at, MIT, you know, things like this. You hear about this all the time. They create this mythos and it just self-perpetuates, you know, and it's the same thing now with Heather Heyer. They named that street in 4th Street is now named after her in Charlottesville. They have all sorts of artwork and even folk songs about her. So they like this, creating this mythos, and it serves kind of a meta purpose, you know what I mean, to bully people into accepting liberal agendas. Then there's other ones. These are just the three that Trayvon Martin, Heather Heyer, and Matthew Shepard are just three that I'm most aware of. But there's, you know, many other situations like that. They're very big on creating this fake folklore.
Yeah, and of course that's important because we see in the wake of these events, and I would, you know, if we for a moment compare it to something like an Islamic attack, specifically in Europe, but it's the same in America when it's happened there too, that it's a very, it's almost like a religious ceremony around the event afterwards, right, in the wake of that, where everyone is coming together and there's concerts and stuff like this. And it's not like anything which is like, all right, how do we solve the issue or whatnot? It's almost like that the establishment has learned to use that as kind of it's become like a social glue to a certain extent, right? That it actually ties people at least temporarily together, and they're kind of joined in their both anger, but mostly in kind of a desperation over these terrorist attacks that happen and whatnot. And I think that the establishment have been very smart at honing those events and using that. To call in a kind of a mindless way, just like, oh, just what do we need? Well, we just need unity, and that will solve all of these things. Well, wait a minute, there's like extreme political factions here. They're like fighting, and there's ISIS and ISIS, supporters in European countries that are performing attacks against our people. What are we going to do about it? Let's just unite and give us a big group hug, and it will solve the situation, right? So it's like, you know, there's no direction. That's what I'm saying in terms of like how to actually solve the issues. So in this Heather Heyer case, I think they're very much they're seeking to use it in the same way, in the sense that they're trying to create a symbol out of her, which they can kind of use against the right, I guess, to a certain extent, right? And say these are all of these people that were there, and those who have any kind of association or any kind of sympathy, I guess, for some of the positions that some of the people have mentioned, they are demonized instantly and they're associated with killers, right? That's what's happened. That's what they've successfully done, pretty much.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a very, very cynical. It's the thing. Is it just guys like you and I who see how cynical and manipulative this is? I think that the average person sees how phony this is, too. I really do.
I don't know. I don't know.
I mean, well, putting aside the Tumblr crowd, the SJWs, the cat ladies, I think the average person knows that this is, there is a genuine point, 9/11, I think that there's a lot of,
questions,
a lot more to that story, yes.
Questions, yes, I agree.
But I think that there was a certain amount of sincerity in Americans' response to that. I think there was also a lot of manipulation and a lot of people who were they liked being melodramatic and the soap opera element. But I think there was people were genuinely morally outraged and they did genuinely want to help and so forth. But in some of these cases, you know, I think it's preening and it's very fake and artificial. I don't really think that, for instance, people buy into the Trayvon Martin myth. Blacks do, obviously, but I don't think except for, like I said, putting aside the cat ladies and such, the average person, the average white person, or even non, Arab or whatever else, I don't think that they buy this, that Trayvon Martin was, you know, this saint who was just hanging out there in the cold rain, you know, just they don't. And he was just, George Zimmerman just randomly went up and attacked him. And George Zimmerman is proof that this happens every day to black guys. I really don't. I think that the media of OPEC are they're. It's like the emperor's new clothes. People are kind of waiting for somebody to say, no, this is crap. This, whatever, in that case, Trayvon Martin, or in this case, Heather Heyer, you know, whatever the fake. The other big one, of course, we all know is the these photographs of these, you know, refugee children and so forth. You know, people have gotten, I think they've gotten wise that they're being, the emperor has no clothes. These things are not being said in good faith. Right. That's what I believe. But they nevertheless, but people also know simultaneously that they're socially forbidden from, you know, from saying anything bad about Heather Heyer or the dead, you know, refugee child, whatever the case might be. They know they can't say anything, but I don't think that they actually believe in their hearts what they know that they're supposed to believe. So, you know.
Yeah, it's we'll possible.
It's up to, you know, that ultimately then says, okay, well, how do you stop it? You know, how do you stop these people from being how do you stop the media from exploiting these things? And so, well, that comes down to leadership in a way. I mean, it comes, you know, we can have a lot of the leaderless culture on 4chan and the rest, but it does come down to somebody like Trump in lots of ways. Just, for instance, John McCain, right? There was a fake mythos built up around him, like he's this big war hero. And when Trump said he's not a hero, I promise you, Henry, you know, 90% of people were like, yeah, we're really sick of this mythos, this John McCain is this, you know.
I hope so.
So people do like it when, you know, when you slay golden calves. I don't know if you're familiar with that Bible story.
Sure,
but, you know,
yeah, of course.
And, you know, when you have these false deities, and people like that when the big liberal word is debunked. And, of course, usually if you get Snopes and stuff, they're actually not really debunking anything. But it is psychologically satisfying when something, when a true myth, when a true false myth is debunked. And people like that. And so I think that people like it when Trump called out, and if our leadership can continue to push these things, push the truth, and not let these liberal mythos take root. The Duke of Cross case was a good example of a win. Trayvon Martin was a good example of a win on our side for this. Hopefully, God willing, and both of us are, I think, skeptical, but hopefully the James Oxfields Fields case will be a win for us in the end. Right now, obviously, it's not looking good, but we'll see. You know, we still got 3 weeks of trial. Opening statements are probably going to be tomorrow, and you know, I'm cautiously optimistic. It's the my big question is not so much that his attorneys, but I do have faith in them. But it's the judge who I don't want to go into it. I don't necessarily have all the facts in front of me anyway. But this guy's bad. I mean, italicized the word, you know. And like I said, Chris Cantwell has given pretty compelling accounts of the culture there for the jury pool. So those are the two big things that make me most nervous.
You mentioned something about what kind of language even the federal prosecutor, the indictment, was using. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. In the hate crime indictment, I hate to even use the word hate crime. I just want to say very quickly, I'll just make this point very briefly. It was less than 20 years ago where the idea of a hate crime was very controversial. People in America thought it was a violation of all sorts of rules of double jeopardy and First Amendment and so forth. It was a debate topic between George Bush and Al Gore back in the 2000 election. Now we've all just accepted it. Whatever. Okay, fine. So, and he was indicted on these hate crimes. Now, if you read that indictment, which you can find all over the internet, it was signed by Thomas Cohen and Rod Rosenstein. And, the most amazing thing in it is that there's no evidence, zero evidence that he was a terrorist or had any sort of intent to harm anybody at all. There's not even accusations of it. And so, instead of presenting evidence like grown men, what they do is they basically cut and paste, liberal buzzwords. James Alex Fields, these are not direct quotes. I don't have it in front of me, but this is a sort of thing that they've written it. James Alex Fields made many social media posts that dehumanized historically oppressed groups. This is a federal indictment that where they want to put a man to death for this. And that's the sort of language that makes up the entire document. The only piece of evidence they'll say, they say it a lot of rote facts. James Alex Fields lived in Toledo, Virginia on August 11th, 2017. He drove from Toledo, Ohio to Charlottesville, Virginia. He started his trip And that, you know, they just wrote facts like that, but that's obviously got nothing. That's not accusatory. So there's two kinds of things in the federal indictment. It's the wrote facts, we all know, which are pointless, and then this Tumblr at language. I mean, so you have these guys. You know, many people have this idea of these federal G-men, as they used to be called, but guys in the FBI and stuff, as these real square-jawed Captain America guys who would say things like, you know, just the facts, ma'am, and they, you know, they're hardcore. And instead, you read this indictment, and it's literally, aside from those just boring rote facts, it's Tumblr at language. And so perhaps I should read it again and siphon out some of those passages in it. But it'll be things like, he expressed doubts about established World War II narratives or World War II facts and things like this. Where's the crime, buddy? You know?
Right.
And,
it's
page after page of that. It's amazing.
And this is why it's so important, of course, to kind of, that the left have managed to run the discourse and really just be the leader of the cultural narrative overall. And with media, with news media and everything, TV shows, movies and everything, kind of create an environment which isn't really legally based, but it's morally based, right? And the morality, the question of morality when it comes to, for example, white people just taking their own side or basically don't wanting to have statues of their ancestors being ripped down in the towns and cities which historically, they're predecessors built, right? It's an opposition. I've repeated this, but it bears repeating because this is what the mainstream media does. They repeat and they brainwash people with their propaganda, right? So we have to emphasize these things again, that it's like there has to be a recognition that there is legitimacy in protesting something which is happening all over the West right now, which is leading to not only just replacement, but us being dispossessed, and there's an expectation that we should just be nice and shut up about it, and just not draw attention to it, because we can't. It doesn't. What's happening when it comes to mass immigration and cultural Marxism and the changing of the environment is not something which is being democratically decided on by the people. It's just something that kind of happens underneath the political system, and in some cases above the political system too. And so our ability to take part in that dialogue and to protest and to voice our concerns and all this kind of stuff, that's, I think, is a very important aspect of a healthy society to prevent that people freak out and snap and just flip out who are not mentally sound and stuff like this, right? And give people an outlet and ability to take part in that discourse and try to effect change. But effectively what has happened is that we're now in a position where we can't voice these things. And the establishment is using events like this to associate everything that people on the right is talking about with the events that took place in Charlottesville, right? So they're effective at doing it, but ultimately I think that they're shooting themselves in the foot, because what's happening is that people are getting increasingly more and more frustrated about that, and that's when things turn dangerous. And I don't want that. I don't want to have violence on the streets. I don't want to see all of this stuff happening now that's happening. But if you have an establishment that is just going to deny people from partaking in the democratic process, I guess, in the cultural dialogue, for the lack of a better term, then likelihood is going to keep happening in the future. What do you make of this?
Well, I think it's important to note that James Oxfield is not a case of a response to the culture that us being oppressed. He wasn't. This was simply a fluky car accident. But
I'm saying he's there for that reason. That's what I'm saying.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
He finds himself in that car on that street at that time because he shares some of these views that, yeah, actually, I think it's a bad idea to replace all white people and have this hyper anti-white agenda, in America right now. I would assume, right? I would assume he agreed with that.
Oh, for sure, yeah. He was, I guess in our terminology, woke. He was on 4chan, that's known. So if you're on 4chan, then there's nothing that, he is aware of, basically every one of our major gripes on some level.
Right.
So what was I going to say? But I'm skeptical of the claim of the, you know, yeah, I hear what you said, or that sentiment, I think, pretty regularly that there's going to be more, guys like the synagogue shooter and so forth. And that might well be true. That's, I'm not denying that. What I am saying is that I don't think that that's going to change the establishment at all. I don't think I think the establishment is very happy to just accept that collateral damage. And we've seen that in many, I mean, this has been going on in France and England and Germany, I think. I mean, all over Europe for long before here in the EU and the United States, right? And it's never deterred them. In fact, they've just been ramping it up. So I think that they're perfectly happy to accept some degree of terrorism. I don't think that they're going to get too much of it from white people anyway. That's not so much our way. I think you'll probably get more white people who, you know, as far as their frustrations, yeah, just end up, you know, taking drugs and things like that. Even if theoretically, like almost every single day, there's like a white person who's flipping out and running into a synagogue, or a white person who's flipping out, you know, obviously neither of us are condoning this or anything. Let's say right now there's some horrible white terrorist who goes and shoots up a bunch of noble, wonderful refugees or something. I don't think that that would deter them, even if that happened every single day.
No, I think it benefits them. I think that that's what they want ultimately. And again, that's how I see that they use Charlottesville. If it wasn't this, there would have been something else. And of course, it was something else. Then you had the synagogue shooting, you know, other events that they're using. But I think that it's effectively they can use it in such a way that the political opposition that comes from the right and that, you know, the kind of the mainstream dispossession of whites, that kind of narrative that's being run, that is effectively shut down every time an event like that happens. You know, that's what people said after like the synagogue shooting, like, okay, well, who does this benefit? It's basically is benefiting the establishment, because now they can crack down on people and they can call people names, and they can even associate basic right-wing views with the terrorism. And I think that they're interested in doing that. But what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it goes both ways. I'll make a little metaphor. I remember reading a story about the Sega Genesis versus Super Nintendo console wars. I think in Europe you guys use the PC more, but here in America it was a huge thing in the early 90s. And the Super Nintendo was by and large the better hardware, but there was a discussion by the marketing guys at Genesis to say, well, we have to make our machine sound better. And the guy said, well, look at, you know, break them open and find something about our machine that's better. And if there's nothing in our machine that's better, we'll just make it up. And it's a similar thing. You know, either they're going to find excuses to create, they're going to find maybe quote unquote legitimate excuses or have some cause to crack down on us. And if they don't, they'll just make something up. You know what I mean? Like either way, they're going to silence us. You know what I mean? It's at this point, the system is so explicitly malevolent and hostile to us in every way, shape, and form. I mean, there's no escape, you know. I'm personally of the opinion it's so rotten, and it's been going on for many decades now. We need to have clean breaks. I'm an American, and I don't want anything except for kind of like the America, you know, that I grew up in and so forth. But I don't believe that we can just bit by bit take things back. It would take, I think it's impossible. And if so, it would take a second. The time it would take to do that, you might as well just build up a whole country anyway, you know. So that's why I'm in favor of, pushing for, you know, secession. And unfortunately, America, and a guy I know you're familiar with, Sam Dixon, he's good at talking about the history that America has. And this predates any of the current anti-white culture, but America has a history of basically straight imperialism, whether it's the Civil War or the Utah Wars, which is ideologically identical to the Civil War, where the Mormons built up Utah and the army surrounded them and said, you're not allowed to have your own country. This is America. And they said, we're going to either submit to us or we're going to kill you all. And so America has a history of not allowing people to say, no, thanks, we opt out. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so
yeah.
I don't know. So we're going to have to change that. And we have to, Greg Johnson has a good word. I mean, I don't know, good, but divorce as opposed to secession. But I'm personally of the opinion that everything is just so rotten from pillar to post. And, yeah, the oppression is so multifaceted, everything from you know, Instagram to, you know, the President of the United States. Everybody censored and repressed.
But, you know, so. The establishment is pretending like we're nuts, right? And that this is not happening. And why people use the term gaslighting, right? It's Jedi mind trick. It's like you're doing something, you're getting away with something, and then they're just like, but it's not happening, right? But then you do get interesting people like Angela Nagel that shows up, that basically admits, she did this in the wake of Charlottesville too. She wrote an article for The Atlantic called Lost Boys. And it basically admitted that the observations that many of the people that went to that event had is largely correct. There is an ongoing dispossession. There is mass migration into the West. There is she didn't use this word, but she, in a roundabout way, kind of admitted that there is an anti-white culture, right? But we should basically just be nice and lay down and not notice that. And she was even on the view that the establishment better stop pushing so hard because these people are actually waking up and noticing. And that's the bad thing, you see. It's bad that we're noticing this. The replacement and the takeover needs to happen more slowly, you see, so people don't wake up and get angry about it. And she was even on Tucker recently having a debate about that too. Like, hey, stop with the open borders. They're waking up here, these guys, you know?
Yeah, I've heard that several times. That's something that Mike Enoch talks about, and he talks about how they'll just literally one tweet to the next, they'll say the complete opposite thing. They'll say, like you said, if you call attention to, let's say, replacement level immigration, they'll say it's wacko conspiracy theory or, you know, whatever. And then the next tweet, they'll say, you know, give it up, white man, your time's done. <You know? laughs> I'm sure you've seen all those memes, you know, about how, you know, white supremacy or white nationalism, the scourge, which must be eradicated. And then that same columnist, next article, Israel is a Jewish state and, its, you know, its Jewish essence must never be compromised.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
It's the same thing. I mean, this is a quick digression, if you'll indulge me. That sort of duplicity and dishonesty is something that I can't intellectually perform. And I don't think you could. I don't think most white people can. And that was why I think it's a mistake to talk about like us having like a long march through the institutions to reclaim, you know, the military and universities and so forth. I don't think that we can keep our mouths shut and be duplicitous about our intents the way that, you know, our opponents can. You know what I'm saying? Like I could for that those straight double talking tweets that, you know, and these things that we're talking about. I could not do that if, you know, I tried. My heart aches when I tell such lies. And I think that that's the way most people are. I mean, you can lie for a little bit, and maybe you can lie for a little bit of money and stuff like that, yes. But as far as a whole lifestyle for decades and decades, no, most people are not capable of that. There are sociopaths, sure, I mean, but 90%, I think, of Gentiles are, frankly, of any race, but certainly, you know, European Gentiles, I don't think are capable of such prolonged dishonesty. So I was very, very skeptical in that whole thing. Oh, we're going to take over the GOP. We're going to have our own long march to the institutions. I'm like, well, I couldn't put up a front like that if, you know, for a week, let alone for, you know, a whole career. If I was trying to, let's say, become a military general and then change the culture of the military, you know what I mean? Or something like that. I could not do that. And I don't think many people could. So
we're going to wrap up here soon, but let's have some kind of closing, you know, thoughts on this. I do want people to go to your YouTube channel, and check out the videos. There's a lot of simulations, a lot of good material there for people that are interested, truly interested in this and not just interested in, bashing the side that they think is wrong. And then just go on to point fingers and put blame, but you know, actually try to figure out what actually happened and have a modicum of objectivity and truth into this picture and see what happened. And of course, I would hope that everyone would like to see a fair trial. Unfortunately, I don't think that it's going to be that. There's going to be things like this happening. A story out of CBS 19, the local there in Virginia, in Charlottesville, talking about how robocall makes anti-Semitic racist claims about Heather Heyer's death. I mean, this could be, as I'm saying, there's so much things around this and the tension and that this is a node point that frankly, poor James Fields, who have ended up in this situation, in a way, even if he, I mean, I'm not even going to entertain that he did it intentionally because he just seems so outlandish at this stage. But let's assume that he did. Let's just take that position, right? even in that case, there is much more than just his actions that it's piled on to all of this. That's my point, that there's so many sides that, or there's two sides from it, but they're seeing this as a focal point and wanting to use this event to move the window, if you will, the Overton window to a certain extent, but just move the needle there in their direction, basically. So this could be an article like this, or the event like this could be, it could be anything. This could literally be like the FBI doing this kind of stuff, right? You know, just to like ramp up even more antagonism and kind of hatred around this to ultimately try to affect people and affect the jurors too, right? How are they going to not see these kinds of stories? How are they not going to know these kinds of things? They will be affected by this kind of stuff, right?
Right. Yeah. And the juries, we know how liberalism generally, but the SJWs in particular, have a way, a talent. I think it's just entropy, to be perfectly honest. I think it can be explained through physics, but a way of always spreading. And so if there's, you know, just if there's three honest people in the jury and there's nine SJWs, they'll push until they win. The SJWs will. Box Day has done, good kind of analysis of that. It's just their habit for spreading and infecting thing. And it's a dumbing down, a regression to the mean. But yeah, I mean, they're not sequestered. The jury is not sequestered. So they'll be free to look. They're instructed not to, but everyone knows that.
Yeah, they will, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. And, so that's, if somebody's out there right now, somebody listens to them, they're on Twitter, they're on 4chan, they're on wherever, that gives you incentive. The juries might well see your memes. It gives you incentive to make good arguments. It gives you incentive to push out the car was only going, at a maximum of 25 miles per hour. Hopefully his defense attorneys will hit these points. I'm pretty confident they will. But in case they don't, you can hit that.
Yeah. What else do you think we should mention here at the end? And I'd like to have you back on the show later on as the trial proceeds, and we could talk more about some things we didn't have time for today. There's a lot of details and stuff like that, obviously, about this. But again, it's a highly politicized event. There's so much hinging on this. There's so many people that are seeking blame. They want blood, and to a certain extent, they've also already gotten blood. Remember all. How many people suffered just from censorship in the wake of Charlottesville, right? And for every event that happens like this, you just see an limiting ability for people who are dissidents to continue to voice their concerns and stuff like this. And it's like that corridor is closing. The noose is tightening, if you will. And again, I don't think that that's a good thing. I think the solution to it is more more speech, have more free speech, if you can say such a thing. But it's like, what else do you think is important to focus on and get out here in the last few minutes that we have?
Well, I think as I would almost flip everything you said around as far as you're focusing on how they, they're using this as the excuse or, the starting point for all of the censorship. And they built, as we talked about prior, this whole mythos, folklore around this case. That's why it's so important for us to win. It's so important for us to win the meme wars, as we did in the George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin case. Incidentally, I think that Trayvon Martin case was almost, along with Gamergate, I think that really forged the alt-right as we define it, I really do. I mean, that was huge on social media, as social media was just taking off. So I think that this can be like that. As much, if he wins this case, I'm very confident that we'll then, instead of them having the mythos, the Heather Heyer mythos, we'll have the James Fields mythos. This guy in a car accident was railroaded, by cops and prosecutors. I like to use rhetoric. He was a working man. He made $10.50 an hour. I like to say this is the establishment fighting the working man, kind of flip that stuff around on them. I don't know how effective that is, but I like to do that. So I think that this is very, very, very important for us, for our culture, just like the Kavanaugh hearings was independent of James Alex Fields' life, which, is on the line, literally, which I guess would be the most important thing. But I think that just for the alt-right as a culture, I mean, the Kavanaugh hearings where we all came together and we're memeing and we were winning till we all felt it, the Trump election, of course. These things are very, very important for us to have some wins, have some real fights and some real wins. And I think that this one, in a way, because he's so darn innocent, it's almost like a gift to us, in terms of being able to rage a meme war. But I did want to hit on three quick points. I don't know if you had any responses to any of that before I hit these 3 points.
No, please go ahead and we'll wrap up on those.
Okay, sounds great. Okay, the first is to again emphasize the prosecution will not be making an argument that that this was not a car accident. They have no evidence for it.
Do you know that for sure, or is that a speculation?
99% sure based upon the pretrial hearing, the federal indictment, and their witness list. All I can say that it's going to be nonstop soap opera. That's it. The other thing is when talking about this, they always use the word, if you read the media articles, car attack, which of course presumes is guilt, which they're not supposed to do. They should say alleged car attack, but they don't. But so they love those words, car attack. Well, we use the words car accident. Put those words out there, car accident. Anytime you're talking about this, is obviously you guys can meme how you want, but this is what I would say. Just put that out, and it triggers them. Believe me, I've had tweets with these Antifa and stuff. If you say car accident, it sends them into rage. Secondly, the other thing, we talked about this before, but the defense the media is obviously trying to hide the car speed. There have been zero reports on it. In every other car accident you look at, they will say the car speed in miles per hour. Here, there's no such estimate of the car speed. So they know that's a weak point. So hit the car speed. Average speed, 21 miles per hour. Two independent investigations on that. And so there's just those things. Hit the car speed, use the words car accident, and then remember that the prosecution has no case. Ask somebody, what is your evidence that this was not a car accident? Right there. It sends them into rage. And then there's one other thing. Andrew Angwin, we've all had our problems. I think I have big-time criticisms of the Daily Stormer and the direction they've gone and everything. But Andrew Angwin wrote a wonderful – he had a great quote about this case. He's very, very cynical. He's, like you, I think, much more pessimistic than I am. I think he thinks it's a kangaroo court as well. But he said something at the bottom. He said, if James Fields is convicted on federal charges of murder – then this is going to be grounds upon which to declare that the federal government is no longer capable of administering justice to the American people and should thus be abolished completely. Those are strong words. He's literally saying that this is the case, this trial, the credibility of the United States government hinges upon this trial. But I think he's right. I mean, this is such a farce, such an abject, miscarriage of justice that, the importance of it can't be overstated, based in my opinion.
Interesting. Yeah, that's interesting take on it. Now, let me pull that article up here too. We have the opening statements that are going to begin. We're recording this here on the Wednesday, so tomorrow, Thursday. That's going to be interesting. And again, we'll see how much of that becomes accurately reported on and everything like that. And we'll see if it's. I would assume it all goes down into the record and the people can take part of that nonetheless. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where this goes. Yeah, I definitely want to have you back at some point as the trial continues, and we could talk about some of the details, see what comes out, and see what your take on it, the whole thing is. But in the meantime, before we let you go, tell us about your YouTube channel, where people can find it, and your Twitter as well, if they want to follow you.
Twitter is Alt-Right Truth, and the YouTube channel is I'm on Gab also. And Twitter and YouTube, it's an old handle I created. Like many people, I've gone through many different social media handles. It's an old handle I created, but the username is White Boner. So
nice.
If you look for that in one word on YouTube or on Gab, it's that. And the videos, I think, pretty much speak for themselves. I wouldn't politely ask people to, if they can find the time, to watch several of them, because there, I think there's so many critical points, so many good propaganda tidbits that, that whichever one speaks to you, if you don't see it in the first video, you might see it in the second or third one that you watch. So there's probably approximately 12 videos. One video we didn't hit on here is the two videos of other cars being attacked, including one car being attacked right at that same intersection the car accident occurred at. Those are on my YouTube channel. So there's so much there that you guys can get. And also, I would also advise people, if you're really interested, Jack Corbin on Gab and Cy Borgeson's video collection. Although, all that hard front that we're pretty much done with now, but if you want to go, those are two of my big sources.
Okay, interesting. Well, good job on wading through all this material and showing an interest in it and talking about it as well. It's a really important case. We'll see how things go, and in the meantime, keep up the good work, and we'll stay in touch, and we'll have you back on the show, okay?
Thanks, I really appreciate it, Henry.
All right,
you guys.
Thanks.